Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Last summer was marked by drought and forest fires. Just one, the House River Fire, burned over 255,000 hectares in the Alberta Pacific Forest Management Area. The burned trees can actually be salvaged and used in the pulp mill, but this operation must be carried out within 2 years of the fire before the wood deteriorates. On the other hand, forest ecologists are concerned that we don't get carried away trying to salvage too much. There are certain species of animals and plants that are completely dependent on the habitat created by recent fires. And WestGrid, this new supercomputing network, has been launched in Alberta and British Columbia. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. I have to admit that I love flying in helicopters. So when the people from Alberta Pacific Forest Industries offered to fly me into their salvage operations at the House River Fire, well, I jumped at the chance.
These ugly looking trees here with the cones on them, those are pine. And that's another species that originates through fire there.
The House River Fire took out 255,000 hectares of boreal forest on the way up to Fort McMurray. Yet flying over the ground below, I could see the incredible mosaic the forest fire had left on the landscape. There were huge patches of dark burned wood, intermixed with islands of green living trees. And after landing at the salvage site near Conklin, one of the communities threatened by the House River Fire, I could see young aspen and fireweed were already rising above the ashes. My guide was Vince Eggleston, an operations planner with Alberta Pacific.
Well, aspen's a pioneer species, and one of the things that pioneer species do is immediately after a disturbance, they will sucker in. So what we have coming back here is all kinds of natural regeneration. So after we harvest this, or even after we leave it, you have a brand new forest replacing what was burnt and lost in the fire.
Some of these, how high are they?
These ones here that were near right now are probably up around 2 feet. Depending on when the fire burnt, they could be taller, probably as much as a meter after a summer. So they grow like weeds and quite vigorously.
Wish I could get my petunias to grow that fast.
Isn't that the truth?
There must be an awful lot of fertilizer or something that's released in the soil from the fire.
Well, in a fire like this, it depends how intensely it burns, but there is a process called mineralization that happens, which converts a lot of the down woody material and moss and stuff like that into basically carbon nutrients, and the plants like aspen or the other vegetation will use it to help them grow, I guess.
Vince and I stood in the large stand of burned aspen. A feller buncher was working close by. Despite the fire, the trees could still be used in Alpac's pulp mill.
What we're amongst right now is an active harvesting show. What we're doing is we're salvaging the burnt timber to bring into the mill.
What are the special considerations for this? Because it's not the same as just going out into an unburned spot to get wood. Do you have to do anything special?
Basically, what we're doing that's different is fire salvage plans are largely abbreviated. The window that we have to plan and operate are a lot shorter than we normally would. In a normal harvest plan, we have about a 2-year planning window, and that gives us time to, get a lot of adequate input from other stakeholders, that type of thing. When we enter into fire salvage, what happens is that window is closed down to about a 2-month window. We still have all the same requirements to notify the stakeholders, get their input. However, we just have a shorter time to do it. So that really is the biggest impact.
Now, it's really only good for you for a year or two, isn't it?
That's right. We've never really pushed the window, but kind of the number that is considered as a 2-year window. Beyond that, the timber is considered to be unmerchantable.
one of the things I notice about the way the feller buncher is operating is he's not cutting down close to the ground. He's actually cutting up fairly high, probably, 6 or 8 feet?
Yeah, that's right. Because our process back at the pulp mill is pretty much intolerant of any carbon, what he's doing is he's cutting above the burnt portion of the tree. That way we're just taking in the unburnt portion of the tree back into the mill.
Is it any harder on him as an operator to get in there and do that?
I think maybe initially it is. You know, they have to be able to gauge where the burn is on the tree, how high it comes up, because we put a lot of responsibility on the operator that they're delivering a clean product to us. So we check their what we call log quality to make sure that there's no carbon in it. So pretty much with every tree he cuts in a salvage operation, he's having to make a decision of where to cut it and how high.
Do you do much extra processing in the field?
Definitely. With green timber, you know, these fellas can basically just go on autopilot and do their job. But with burnt timber, they're constantly looking at the piece of wood that they're processing. And if there's any burn, they're having to remove that. Sometimes the fire will burn out branch stubs that are higher up the tree that aren't really visible. So they have to be quite aware and on the ball when they're doing their job.
Fire salvage, that's something that's relatively new. It's not something you've heard about too much in the past. What is the shape of things to come?
Well, that's going to be largely dependent upon what kind of fires happen in the future. I guess the reason we haven't seen it too much in the past is we haven't got these large catastrophic fires on our FMA, like the House River fire here, for instance. So we really haven't had to do much salvaging in the past. So the government does mandate us to take burn or fire salvage. So if there's any fires in the future on the FMA, you know, we'll definitely have to assess them and if feasible, come out and salvage the timber.
Now, there's a whole bunch of new stuff coming out this year as a result of these huge fires, and one of them is a new protocol that's being set up for salvage by the government. What are the considerations? Why can't you just go in there and take it all down?
Well, you know, there's still considerations that we have to look at, such as wildlife. We still want to provide structure for them, hiding cover where possible, thermal cover. We want to consider, you know, certainly the ungulate population, birds, as well as watershed values. We are still operate under all the same rules in burn that we would normally in green timber. So along water courses, creeks and such, we leave buffers and that type of thing. So we're still addressing those types of concerns or the same concerns we would in green timber.
Well, he's really moving ahead with bringing these trees down. How much do you think you're going to get out of this?
Well, there's three fires on the FMA that we're going to be salvaging here this winter. The House River fire, the one we're in now, is obviously the largest. And this fire here, we're expecting approximately 1.9 million cubic meters, which is quite substantial when you consider that our annual cut is probably around 2.3, 2.4 million cubic meters. So the salvage out of this fire will constitute a large portion of that.
So that means you won't be cutting down any natural forest for a little while?
No, as a matter of fact, we expect that we'll be in here for the next year and a half. So basically our green salvage plans will be deferred until we're finished salvaging in here.
What's the cost factor like?
We do realize some increased costs because of the additional work that the contractors have to do when they're salvaging. How much, it kind of varies, but we do know that there definitely is increased costs. Not only just because of the additional work that the contractors have to do to get a carbon-free product for us, but also because we're having to go into a lot more scattered areas. So there's other associated costs with road building and maintenance and those types of things that we wouldn't normally have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Vince Eggleston, a forest operations planner with Alberta Pacific Forest Industries.
Sean Plomenden is the contractor operating the feller buncher to salvage these burned trees.
It's kind of the same thing, except you got more maneuvering, and you're double cutting all your trees instead of just cutting once. You're cutting the same tree twice.
And why is that?
Because if we'd leave all the burnt stumps standing, then we wouldn't be able to move around in here, I guess.
So where would you cut them then if you're cutting them twice?
Above the burn and then below the, like, at ground level.
What happens to the stuff that's left then? If you're cutting it up above and down below, does that get left here or does that also get taken to the mill?
No, that stays here and that, I believe, becomes fertilizer. So,
tell me a little bit about your machine.
Oh, it's a good machine. it's due for a new one, but I enjoy it. I've been doing this for 10 years, so.
How many trees can you take at once?
Depending on the size, like if it's between 8 to 10 inch, if I was cutting at the ground level, I'd probably take 7, 8 at a time.
How long do you think you'll be working in this part?
We'll be done tomorrow. And then we're moving down south.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Plomenden, a feller buncher operator working with Tier Logging Contractors on Alpax FMA. Rob Thompson is the forest officer with Alberta Sustainable Resource Development, who looks after the Lac La Biche forest area.
Well, my role in all this fire salvaging is making sure operationally everything gets done the way it's supposed to. The guidelines, the protocols, the ground rules, Alpac ground rules are all followed and adhered to.
Now, fire salvage is actually something quite new, isn't it?
Well, it's been happening for a long time, but we haven't had any protocols in place to deal with fire salvage. It was kind of an ad hoc thing in the past. So this is a new for everybody, I think.
Why are you looking at protocols?
Just so we can get a handle on the way we do things. Consistency with all the companies. So, you know, every company is doing the same thing. And, you know, so we as a government, I guess, you know what we're doing and know how we want to do it and what it's supposed to look like at the end.
Well, this year you've had to deal with fairly intensive fires. There was the House River fire. How much land did that actually burn up?
Right around 250,000 hectares, productive and non-productive land base.
So that makes it fairly intensive when it comes down to the salvage?
Well, salvage-wise, it's probably, I'm guessing quarter of the fire, probably less than a quarter of the fire area that we're actually salvaging.
What is it now that you're actually looking at? What do you have to watch for when you're out there? There is the salvage operations that Alpac is doing.
Right now I deal with everything from approving the blocks after they're laid out, and you know, I look at creek crossings, road right-of-ways, widths, utilizing existing lines versus building new roads, stand structure. I mean, everything that's in the ground rules, basically.
Does that mean then that they would actually be cutting it the same way they would if the forest hadn't burned?
That's the intent. Like, all the burnt blocks are supposed to look like an actual green block, you know, harvest-wise. You know, they're using the same rules. Same rules apply as far as Alpac goes.
Is there a narrow window in which salvage can be done?
I'm thinking 2 years.
Why is that?
The bugs, pests, you know, the woodpeckers. The bugs and the woodpeckers, that's the big thing. And after the bugs get in there, you know, as far as conifer goes, there's not much value to the wood, I guess.
From a timber supply point of view.
Yeah, and, you know, you're taking the wood, taking it to the mill. I guess the bottom line is they want to sell the 2x4. And if it's economy grade, and, you know, who wants economy grade?
How about from an ecological point of view? What are the considerations there?
You know, everything has to be considered, obviously. And, I think we're doing the best we can, or with the best knowledge that we have. You know, we're doing the best we can, taking everything into consideration, you know, from the bugs to the birds to the animals and the future plants that are going to come up out of these fires. And until we know more, I guess, you know, flying by the seat of our pants kind of thing.
Thank you very much, Rob.
You're quite welcome.
That was Rob Thompson, a forest officer from the Lac La Biche forest area with Alberta Sustainable Resource Development. Incorporating fire ecology into salvage operations in the new protocols is a major concern for forest scientists. Dr. Elston Dews is a biologist working with Alberta Pacific Forest Industries.
Well, the fires that we've seen, especially in the last few years, are part of a natural system that's been going on for tens of thousands of years. And the plants and animals that are in the boreal system have adapted to this. And so when you add on top of that timber harvesting onto existing fire areas, you have to look at whether or not the effects of one, i.e. harvesting, are additive over on top of the natural disturbance, which is fire. And there are many species of plants and bugs and birds that some people say are dependent or at least very associated with fires, at least especially in the first few years after a fire.
Can you give me an example?
So on a bird side of things, there are black-backed and three-toed woodpeckers that are very associated with these fires. They're found in higher densities and they come in right after the fires, and they're largely going after a food source. And there are various beetle species that I don't have expertise in that have sensors that allow them to detect either the smoke or the heat via special infrared sensors, and so they can detect fires from long ways away. They come in and make use of the dead and dying trees as habitat.
So it's important for these burned areas to actually exist.
Yes, on a landscape scale, you certainly wouldn't want to remove all of the burnt timber from these areas. You can probably take off a given amount without affecting the populations of these fire-dependent animal and plant species, but the question is how much? In a workshop that we held in April of 2002, we've got together researchers from the University of Alberta, Alberta Research Council, the provincial government, and Canadian Wildlife Service, and we looked at the last 10 years of research, of which there's been a lot of work done in Alberta, looking at or comparing the effects of fire versus timber harvesting. So we looked at what's known, what's not known, and a lot of the work had been done comparing harvest on sort of green areas or unburnt areas, which is sort of the normal harvesting approach, to fires. What came out as one of the large gaps was, what's the effect of harvesting these burnt areas? So you're providing sort of two disturbances into one area. And there was general agreement that that was the biggest gap in our knowledge, was what's the effect of salvage logging on these post-fire dependent species of plants, birds, and bugs.
So what will this group be doing in order to research that?
Well, we've initiated a collaborative research project with the Alberta Research Council, the University of Alberta. Those will be the key leads. We've also got involvement from Canadian Wildlife Service and the provincial government. And the focus will be over the next 2 years in the House River fire area to take a look at the effects of different amounts of salvage logging on these fire-dependent birds, beetles, and plants. So it's going to focus specifically on that, and we're going to compare the results in the harvested areas to unharvested control areas.
Will this be incorporated then into the new protocols that the government is developing for salvage logging?
Yes, it was certainly, I think, a significant step that the provincial government acknowledged these unique ecological areas or times in that early post-fire time period, and have provided or started to develop a framework around salvage logging. They themselves acknowledged that there was a lot of unknowns in it, and so this research will certainly inform the development of future salvage logging protocols.
Thank you very much, Elston.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Elston Dews, a biologist working with Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. I asked his colleague, forest ecologist Simon Dyer, about the critical gaps in our knowledge of fire species.
Well, there's a few things I guess I'd like to point out. First of all is that burnt areas are unique habitat. Those early successional post-fire areas. We can't recreate that habitat either through our normal harvest operations or through salvage logging. So it's really important to maintain a portion of the landscape unsalvaged. These early successional areas are really important for a number of reasons. The downwood they recreate, the habitat from the burnt timber, and certain plant species need that fire in order to regenerate.
You say that there's a knowledge gap. What are the critical issues?
Well, when a fire burns through an area like the House River fire, it tends to leave these green islands or skips, patches of forest that escape being burnt. What role those green islands play in the recolonization of the burnt areas, or how they act as refuges, we don't really know. So there's a lot of work we can do in that area. The second issue is how much structure, both green and black, do we need to retain within these blocks to maintain biodiversity?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Simon Dyer, a forest ecologist with Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. I also spoke with Dr. Elston Dews, Vince Eggleston, Sean Plamondon, and Rob Thompson. After 2 years of intense work, WestGrid is now a reality. This $50 million project essentially connects computers between 8 research institutions across Alberta and British Columbia in such a way that they become one huge supercomputer. Involved are the universities of Alberta, Calgary, and Lethbridge, Simon Fraser University, UBC, as well as the Banff Centre, the New Media Innovation Centre, and Triumph Physics Laboratories. The WestGrid launch linked participants by video conference between Edmonton, Calgary, Vancouver, and Ottawa. Afterwards, I talked with Dr. Jonathan Schaefer, one of the 5 principal investigators with WestGrid.
This is not politically correct at this time, but with all the power deregulation, but we all know what a power grid is. Whenever I want electricity, I just go to a wall socket, plug it in, and all of a sudden I have the electricity that runs my electric razor or my portable television or whatever. Whenever I need electricity, it's there and available. What we have today is, in building the Western Canada Research Computing Grid, is the ability to create a computing infrastructure that every researcher in Western Canada can access. So that if a professor in Lethbridge wants to certain kinds of computing resources that are here at the University of Alberta, he can access them as if they're right in the next room. And so what we're doing is creating this grid of resources, this seamless environment that allows us all to get this kind of access to multi-million dollar pieces of equipment just as easily as plugging into the wall.
What makes that possible?
It wouldn't have been possible a few years ago, but what really makes it possible today is the fact that we have high-speed networking. Both Alberta and British Columbia have invested in world-class leading-edge networking that connects the major institutions together. And Canada, with their Canary Project, has created the infrastructure to connect the provinces together. And the strange thing is, it's faster for me to access, you know, resources in Calgary in most cases than it is to access resources across campus. Because between Edmonton and Calgary, we have world-class networking capabilities.
Now, your other counterpart in Vancouver, the other Jonathan Boywin, he said that this couldn't have been done in the United States, and so that makes Canada a leader in this. Why not? Why are we a leader, and why couldn't they have done it there?
We have national policies. Canary connects the entire Canadian research landscape together. In the United States, it's fragmentary. It's all over the place. There are little pockets of excellence, but there's no vision for the entire country. And I can assure you, having been to the major conferences in the United States, that our colleagues south of the border are extremely envious of the infrastructure that we have here in Canada.
You've got 3 major vendors here, Hewlett-Packard, IBM, and SGI. And one of the things that really struck me is the amount of computing power. I can't even begin to imagine what that is. For example, terabytes. What's a terabyte?
Well, in terms of computing power, boy. Well, first of all, let me answer your question, what is a terabyte? So if we think about your little desktop computer, you have one computer at home. The WestGrid facility, when it's all said and done, in 2 years, because there's more equipment coming next year, will probably be about 2,000 computers. So it's going to be like 2,000 times more computing horsepower than what you have on your desktop. In terms of memory, I don't know what you have on your desktop. Some machines have, you know, 64 megabytes of memory or 128 megabytes of memory. WestGrid all total will have at least a terabyte. You know, megabytes, then there's gigabytes, which are 1,000 times more than a megabyte, and a terabyte, which is 1,000 times more. So compared to a desktop machine, you know, we might have like 8,000 times the amount of memory, which is astronomical. In terms of disk, it's the same thing. You might have a 30, 40, maybe 70 gigabytes of disk on your machine. Well, we're going to have, I don't know, 50 terabytes. Again, just, you know, many orders of magnitude beyond what people would expect in a desktop machine. And what's why that's so exciting is because researchers can access all of this computing power and solve problems that are 10 or 100 times bigger, more difficult, more challenging than what they could do before WestGrid came online. And that's actually important because if you think about research, it's always a horse race. There's no prize for second place. So if you think of the Indianapolis 500, there's two components to winning the car race. You need a fast car and you need a good driver. Well, in our case, the driver is the science and the car is the computers. If you're in the Indianapolis 500 and you're on a bicycle, I don't care how good you are, you're probably not going to win. And it's the same thing here. If you're doing good science but you only have a PC, maybe you can't do the same things that you could do if you had the resources that WestGrid has. And so now, by having terabytes of disk and terabytes of memory and thousands of processors, people in WestGrid can now dream of the problems, the big problems, the leading-edge problems, the problems that nobody else in the world is brave enough to tackle. Those kind of problems can be done here, and we can reap the benefits by being number one, being the first to get this done.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Jonathan Schaefer, a professor of computing sciences at the University of Alberta and a principal investigator with WestGrid. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. You can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Capital Region Innovation Center, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the University of Lethbridge, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Ingenuity, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, True North Energy, Alberta Research Council, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.